prescriptions in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.
And just a reminder, we'll be taking your calls at 1-800-580-2372, 1-800-580-2372. In about 20 minutes from now for the second hour of our show, any comments, questions, other areas you'd like to hear on the show, please feel free to call in. It's a very enjoyable hour. I look forward to this every week. 1-800-580-2372 in about 20 minutes from now. Scientists at the Blanchet Rockefeller Neurosciences Institute, or BRNI, have discovered that a cancer drug, briostatin, enhances the formation of new connections in rat brains during memory storage. This drug could potentially increase normal memory capacity in humans, as well as repair and restore memory lost from Alzheimer's disease, stroke, and head trauma. In an article published in the December 4th, 2007 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it describes how the cancer drug briostatin stimulates the production of connections between neurons in the same structural way that memory storage does naturally. Briostatin essentially rewires the brain. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Daniel Alcon, Scientific Director of BRNI and co-author of the study. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Barry.
I wanted to first, for our listeners, to get an understanding of the mission statement for the BNRI. What does the BNRI focus upon?
Well, for many years, I was at the National Institute of Health running a program there, and we were doing basic molecular neuroscience, certainly with an eye to the clinic, but with a great deal of, difficulties in actually translating laboratory discoveries so that they could be translated into drugs that could be used for people and diagnostics for people. Our mission in forming the Institute was to facilitate that translation, to still do, hopefully, very basic molecular neuroscience in the brain, but also to facilitate the working of that research toward clinical solutions, toward things that make a difference for people.
So turning towards the basic science aspect, what was the basic science that contributed to your research, especially with regards to this particular study?
Well, you know, for many, many years, and if I'm not mistaken, you were doing, have done similar research, we've been interested in understanding how molecules in the brain actually control structures of the brain to make permanent memory recordings. You know, when the voice or music is recorded in some way on a CD or a tape recorder, there have to be physical and chemical changes to actually store those forever, or at least for a long time. Well, the brain cells that we have in our brain are designed to last often for the full lifetime that we are on this earth. And during that lifetime, we record memories many, many times for the duration of our experience, for our whole lives. And it's a mystery, and it has always been a fascinating mystery to me, as to what actually occurs to make such a long, permanent record. And that mystery has kind of inspired me for many, many years to try to track down the signaling events, the molecular steps that lead to these permanent, ultimately structural changes. And about 7 or 8 years ago, that adventure led us to particular enzymes, particular molecules, that we began to think not only control the memories, but actually control the structure. And then just several years ago, we asked the question, are there drugs that are safe for people that might actually facilitate those steps? And we were very, very fortunate to find this drug about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, called briostatin, which is actually not a statin in the classical sense. We know statins as drugs that lower cholesterol. This is not one of those drugs. But it was a drug that was used by the Cancer Institute for many years, the National Cancer Institute at NIH, to treat or to attempt to treat cancer. So it's been in a couple of thousand patients already. It doesn't work that well in treating cancer patients, although it does seem to work in combination with other drugs. But what was wonderful about it is that it activated exactly the pathways that we had uncovered were important for memory storage. And it activated them with such potency that no other drug that had ever been described was able to do that. And it did it safely, without hurting people. Now, since then, at the Rockefeller Institute, we've actually created a whole collection of these types of drugs. Mm-hmm. We've actually synthesized new drugs that are like this, which have similar properties, but have certain advantages. But this drug, from the very start, showed remarkable properties for enhancing memory. And then we asked a simple question, and we saw these structural changes, if it enhances memory and enhances the structure, maybe it could actually serve as a kind of protection or even a way of reversing destruction mm-hmm. in the brain. So we embarked upon another adventure. We started to introduce a number of different animal models for stroke, for Alzheimer's disease, for traumatic brain injury, for aging. In every single one of these contexts, we saw something that we think is rather remarkable, and that is it protected the cells from dying. And not only that, but it actually induced the growth or the genesis of new connections between the brain cells. And that's called synaptogenesis. So instead of neurogenesis, which is what stem cells
right.
potentially can do, this is synaptogenesis. And for folks who actually are familiar with the destruction inside the brain due to Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease or stroke or traumatic brain injury, there's one common theme. That is, it's the loss of these connections, the loss of these synapses between the brain cells. So if we could, we thought, actually find a way to stimulate the existing neurons, the neurons that hadn't died but were maybe sick, to form new connections, we might be able to rejuvenate the brain's capacity. And that's turning out to be true, and we're really on the threshold of going into the clinic with our first FDA proposal.
So let's take our listeners through the steps of and start with that the initial article from December the 4th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and go through what you actually found when you did this particular study and what the study design was and how you ascertained this improvement.
Well, the first thing that we do, and not all scientists agree with this, but many scientists do, we try to use memory tasks that are directly relevant to human memory. And what does that mean? It means that it has to be the relationships of events or relationships mm-hmm. of information that we have from our experience, not just little isolated bits, but the relationships. And I like to use examples of that. For example, if you remember the face of a loved one, like your mother, you'll remember the relationships of her eyes, her nose, her mouth together, which actually together make a kind of form or gestalt, which is the mm-hmm. face. But it's not that form emerges from those relationships. And then you remember the relationships between her face and the sound of her voice or the sound of her name or the set of emotions that you have. So all of these memories are relational or associative. One of the most beautiful examples of relationship memory that was ever described was described by Pavlov at the end of the 19th century, mm-hmm. for which he won the Nobel Prize. And basically, Pavlov's dog heard the sound of a bell just before he smelled the smell of meat. And he would do that, Pavlov would do that repeatedly. And then after that happened enough times, the dog, just on hearing the sound, would start to salivate as if the meat smell were there, but it wasn't,
mm-hmm.
because the animal's brain had formed a relationship between the sound of the bell and the smell of the meat. Believe it or not, Leibniz, who was one of the discoverers of the calculus, along with Newton in parallel, actually described this exact phenomenon of Pavlovian conditioning something like 300 years earlier in one of his books in a beautiful way. But that model of Pavlovian conditioning is a kind of paradigm that you can measure rigorously and very, very carefully so that you can, if you can eventually identify the molecular changes that occur inside the animal's brain, when the animal forms that relationship, you know that it's just the memory that's
right,
involving that molecular, those molecular events. Nothing else. Not the animal hearing the bell, not the animal smelling the meat, not the animal just being aroused in general, but just the memory. And that's the critical point. You want to find, so we did, and we've done that with actually a number of models. So ultimately, we found that these molecular events were occurring in a whole variety of animal species, in snails, in rats, in rabbits, in a variety of relational or associative type memory paradigms. And once we found that, this was maybe 15, 20 years ago, we asked, well, how are we going to see if this is relevant to humans?
Mm-hmm.
That was the question we asked. And the simple jump was to say, let's ask, what disease affects memory in humans? Well, you know, many diseases affect memory. But there's only one disease that can affect pure memory at the beginning, and that's Alzheimer's disease. When it first begins, it can, it doesn't have to, but it can begin by just an isolated loss of recent memory, what happened to you a few hours ago. So that seemed to suggest that maybe if we looked at patients and we had a way of measuring, let's say, something in the blood or something in the skin without hurting them, maybe we could find some clue that would connect it to the animal pathways and the molecular events that we had been studying. And in the early 90s, in fact, we did find those clues. And unbeknownst to us, at the same time, there were a whole bunch of other laboratories who were adding research that would support exact same pathways. They happen to involve enzymes. The enzymes kind of facilitate reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And one kind of enzyme class is called PKC. And we had implicated many years ago, and for over those years, the whole molecular sequence of events that involve PKC. And it turns out that Alzheimer's disease centrally involves PKC. So that was the first clue that linked a disease of memory to the actual pathways of memory that we had identified. And from there, we started to ask, could we diagnose the disease by seeing defects in that class, PKC enzymes, which we ultimately have, and we hope to bring that. We've already done a 15-university study. We hope to bring that to the clinic soon. And then we asked, could we develop drugs that might target specifically the certain types of PKC, not just any PKC, but certain types of enzyme that are activated during memory. And briostatin was our first choice candidate. And it activated particularly two types of the PKC. And the results were actually beyond our dreams, because we not only used what's called confocal microscopy, which is just a very high-powered microscope, but we used something called electron microscopy, which is another order of magnitude, 10 times or 100 times more sensitive, more magnification. We could actually visualize the synapses. And every change that memory produced in those synapses, the briostatin made it go just that much further. So it was as if the briostatin was enhancing the molecular signature of memory. And that encouraged us to go further with Alzheimer's disease models. For example, you can take mice, and you can actually engineer the genome so that they have human Alzheimer's genes in them. And once they have that, they start to get some of the changes inside their brains that, humans do when they get Alzheimer's disease. And then you can create other models, such as for stroke or for traumatic brain injury, et cetera. And in each of these cases, we use Briostatin. Now we've used other cousins of Briostatin. And in each of these cases, it's had a remarkably positive benefit, therapeutic benefit. So we're kind of excited that this might actually make a difference for people in the next century. That's what we're looking for.
So my final question is, will you be now conducting human trials and moving from the animal model to human trials to see if the effect holds true for people as well?
Absolutely. In fact, we have our first FDA proposal now being considered, and we're discussing a number of other proposals. So our next goal and our focus goal is to bring this to the clinic and in fact, see if we can validate the hypothesis that, in fact, this can make a difference for treating people.
When do you expect these studies to begin? And also, how can people find out more information about the study and the BNRI if they're interested in seeing if they fulfill the protocols?
We have a website. There are always ways of contacting us. We welcome that, as we welcome support as well. The pace at which we will go will, of course, depend on the money we raise. We do have some alliance partners from private sectors. We encourage private sector alliances. We also have philanthropic alliances. And that is what's going to determine, because to do clinical trials costs money, millions of dollars.
Right.
And we want to bring it to people just as soon as we possibly can. And that will be ultimately based on our partnerships that we form. But we're very optimistic. There's a lot of interest right now. And we feel that the field, the whole field of Alzheimer's research, is moving in the direction that we've been working in for the last 20 years. But we'll see.
Dr. Daniel Alcon is Scientific Director of the Blanchet Rockefeller Neurosciences Institute and co-author of the study that appeared in the December 4th, 2007 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, describing how the cancer drug Briostatin stimulated the production of connections in the nerve cells, the synapses, improving the structure in the same way that memory storage does naturally. And Dr. Alcon, I'd like to thank you very much for providing very exciting explanation and avenue that I'm sure a lot of people will be following, and I'd love to have you back on the show to follow up on this.
I'll be happy to return, and it's a pleasure to talk with you, Barry.
All the best.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.